Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, it's primary day in the land of Lincoln and the land of Blago. Can Romney win and take a commanding lead in the delegate count? Can the Santorum momentum be enough to neutralize the Romney freight train? Budget Chairman Paul Ryan released his budget proposal today. What has both the GOP and Dems up in arms? Speaking of the land of Blago, the heated House races in Illinois have created some tension in the GOP leadership. What has Majority Whip McCarthy really angry with Majority Leader Cantor? This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. And good afternoon from a somewhat yet again diversified and disbanded Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio, normally from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. But today I am broadcasting live yet again from the heart of our nation's midsection. Greetings from Claremore, Oklahoma. Joining me as they do every week is the former 8-term member of Congress from Washington 2nd District. He's the former vice president of Burlington Northern Railroad, Congressman Al Swift. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing over there in Oklahoma?
We're wet here today, Congressman. We are wet. We've gotten flooding, all kinds of stuff. It's not a pretty sight, but normally it's beautiful. I'm starting to fall in love with it down here. But I'll be coming back to D.C. soon, I promise. Joining me, as he also does every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, how are you doing, sir?
Well, I'm just fine. We miss you up here.
Yeah, I miss you guys up there, too. From what I'm hearing, the Jack Daniel's supply is overflowing now that I'm down here.
Well, we're taking care of that as much as we can.
That's very good. Very good. Joining me, as he always is, from a undisclosed location somewhere in the metropolitan area, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He is longtime Senate staffer and currently a very, very distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, how you doing, sir?
Hey, guys. I'm doing well.
How's that for an introduction?
I'm right down in D.C. today.
You are in D.C.?
I am. I'm at the Stimson Center.
Oh, wow. Okay. Where you are a very distinguished fellow. Joining me, as he also does, he is the Vice President of China Affairs for the Eurasia Center. He is bar-certified attorney in New York and the District of Columbia. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. Glad to be back in sunny D.C.
Ah, and he is the former chairman of the Maryland Democratic Party. He is longtime Washington insider. Carl Turbin, Mr. Turbin, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing okay. Can you hear me?
We can hear you fine, sir. Thank you very
much. Okay, good.
Well, the gang's all here. We might as well get to it. It's Tuesday, which means that there's a primary or a caucus going on somewhere. And, oh, by golly, it's 54 delegates at stake out there in the great land of Blago, the land of Lincoln, the great state of Illinois. Illinois, a very important state right now. Bob, I'm going to start with you. That's kind of your backyard. Why is Illinois so important this time around as opposed to other years?
Well, number one, it's important because there is still a legitimate question about who the nominee will be. Number two, it's important because it is a relatively large state, which tends to go Democratic when the Chicago machine operates, but still downstate, there's a lot of Republicans, and it will probably be a relatively close fight in the general election. And it's got, I think, 58 delegates, which is a large number. all make reasons to make it important.
Congressman Al, does it surprise you that Illinois is this powerful and could be a determining factor going into Tampa, or is this expected with the field that we've been seeing in the 2012 election so far?
No, I don't think it's surprising because it's typical of Illinois than not atypical. So I don't think it's surprising. I was more surprised by the folks today that was really kind of high on Romney taking it all, which is very bad news for Santorum.
Alan Moore, does this surprise you that it's looking like, and again, if you're judging our history on handicapping these races, well, we're not exactly batting 1,000, but does it surprise you that it seems to be the momentum going towards Romney in a big, big win? We've even got some people saying that he's captured more than 50% of the vote.
Nothing surprises me in this election this year. Last week, 7 days ago, we were looking at Mississippi and Alabama and not knowing what was going to happen, guessing it might be Santorum, suggesting that if Romney were to somehow pull off a miracle win in one of them, it might spell doom for Gingrich. The top three voters last week, the top three candidates, were just within a few points of each other. It was important that Santorum won them all. Romney was not that far behind, which was kind of a moral victory, and on the important delegate count, he did okay. It was a bad day for Gingrich. He was in his neighborhood, and that was supposedly his wheelhouse. The guy has lost 2 out of 30 tries now. He's out of money. He basically walked Gingrich, I'm speaking about now, he basically walked away from Chicago. And then in between we had Puerto Rico, which turned out to be a huge victory for Romney, surprisingly large. So
don't forget Guam. Guam was also a big win for Romney.
Well, and so was Hawaii, which I know we'll get some more later. But all of that sort of, you know, sets up suddenly for this big, important heart of the Midwest state that's got some that's got a great big city, some wealthy suburbs, downstate stuff. It reminds us a little bit of the Michigan and Ohio primaries, but it's coming at a time where Gingrich is hanging on by his fingernails. Paul has kind of drifted off even further into the ether, and so we're increasingly seeing Romney Santorum, and it's turned into kind of a head-to-head contest the way it's turning out. So it's a big deal. It's a very big deal.
Carl, from a Democrat's perspective, are you starting to get the impression that this is quickly becoming a two-man race, that Santorum and Romney, in fact, have pulled away, and that Paul and Gingrich are just now ancillary?
Yeah, I think so. The interesting thing was, while all this was going out in Illinois, somebody spotted Newt at a very swanky restaurant in Washington, D.C. So what that means, whether he's going to get out, he keeps saying he's going to stay in. Santorum sure wants him out. But, you know, it looks like it's a two-man race.
Ralph, you were out in Hawaii, obviously, during the caucus and the primary last week.
Did you get CNN on there?
CNN, oh, yes, thanks. Yeah. Hey, Bob, are they putting CNN on the glass-enclosed nerve center of backroom politics?
That's what they're doing.
Good. Hey, Ralph, back to you. We were talking about the Hawaii primary and the big win for Romney out there. He also took in Guam. What's the attraction out there? I mean, Hawaii's been looked at as a very liberal state. Is the attraction to Romney that he is, in fact, in reality, somewhat of a centrist, and they see that? Or is there a conservative base that truly believes that Romney's the right guy for the GOP?
Well, in Hawaii, what's interesting is, according to David Chang, who's the state GOP chairman, he had predicted the caucuses would draw 5,000 to 10,000 voters. He thought 6,000 was possible. But at the end of the day, over 10,000 Republicans came out with the majority backing Romney. And turnout was strong in areas of the state where Republicans are competitive, such as in East Honolulu and the windward side of Oahu, where I'm from and worked as a poll watcher for Romney. But what happened was it really peaked on the north shore of Oahu, where Romney, who's a Mormon, was expected to perform exceptionally well in the North Shore area near Brigham Young University, Hawaii, and Laie, where his son Matt appeared at several rallies on the Monday before the election. So early returns on Tuesday were suggesting the caucus would be a close clash between Romney and Senator Rhett Santorum, but at the end of the day, the North Shore districts made the result a decisive one for Romney.
Well, when we look at the race today in Illinois, it almost seems like this is Romney's to lose. Bob, is there anything that Romney could do today to make this not work out in his favor?
Well, if he robbed a bank, I think he's going to get 50%.
Really?
It's going to be a big win. I think it's going to be a big win for him.
Now, I mean, you know, we kind of look at, and I want to go to Congressman Al on this one. When we talk about Illinois, you know, the more what we look at, Democratic-leaning areas, the collar counties, as they would put it, you're talking about Cook County, DuPage, Kane, Lake, I think McHenry's in there. When you look at those counties, those tend to be more moderate, more liberal, more Democratic leading. Those will probably be going towards Romney. But when we look at the rest of the state, Springfield, Peoria, down in Pekin, those are hardcore, blue-collar, lunch-pail Republican types that seem to go towards Santorum. Is 50% realistic for Romney in Illinois today, Al?
Well, I think if he gets 50%, it will indicate that in Illinois, you may be able to point to Illinois as the place where it started to turn, where I have a winner and the other candidates can't win, and so we'll hold our nose and vote for Romney in those ultra-conservative districts. That's if he gets to 50%. If he doesn't, they may be the reason that he didn't.
So going to Alan Moore, Alan, is Springfield, Peoria, downstate Illinois going to be the major factor that could possibly even keep Santorum in the race?
Well, you know, we've seen in Michigan and in Ohio that Romney wins the suburbs and builds up big votes in the suburbs of the major population centers, and Santorum does well in the rural areas and downstate. I think we'll see that pattern again, but the signs now are that Romney's probably got a double digit lead. I'll be very surprised if he gets over 50. He hasn't yet, except in Puerto Rico. But remember, Gingrich and Paul are still on the ballot in Illinois. They just basically bailed on it, but they'll each get some votes. Gingrich could fall below 10%, which would be quite embarrassing for him, and he's basically out of money. I just don't, you know, the polls show that it's just not going to be enough for Santorum, the areas where he's going to do well. But that's why we have elections, to find out. And as we have seen, we can speak with certainty or hesitation, and either way, we can be wrong. So we'll see what happens.
I was going to say, I hope Vegas isn't banking odds on us because we're not calling a thing. Bottom line here is when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about what's going on in Illinois. Illinois being a key state in the race and probably going to be a key decision point for people like Gingrich and Ron Paul. But this is Backroom Politics, usually live and today somewhat live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of Oklahoma, Maryland, and the Commonwealth of Virginia. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Hey, can everybody hear?
I can.
Live on Blog Talk Radio. This is Backroom Politics for a rainy Tuesday here in Claremore, Oklahoma, the county seat of Rogers County, the home of Will Rogers and the world-famous Claremore Daily Progress. Joining us from Washington, D.C. are Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Alan Moore, and out in the hinterlands of Maryland, I think Carl Tubin, and Ralph, we don't even know where you are.
I'm in D.C. on Capitol Hill.
Oh, wow. Very good. Hey, we're going to continue the talk today about what's going on out there in Illinois. For those of you who are just joining us, it is primary day in the land of Lincoln, the land of Lago, and they are in the polls right now. Right now, it does look like that it is going to be a two-way race between Romney and Santorum. But I got to go to Congressman Al. Al, this has got to be a key decision point for a campaign like Newt Gingrich, who has not seen daylight maybe since Georgia back on Super Tuesday 2.5-3 weeks ago. At what point, how much longer can Newt Gingrich sustain?
He hasn't been sustaining for months, but he continues to plod along. All the signs a rational person would seize upon to find an excuse to withdraw, he is ignored. So it looks like he's going to stick into it till the end.
And Alan, I mean, you've been watching this unfold. I mean, to somebody who's been around politics as long as you have, at what point do you say this is now becoming less credible and more of a political joke and something you talk about at cocktail parties in Georgetown?
It comes when you have no more money. And he has got about $1.5 million on hand and slightly more than that in debt. That means no money. And there's money not coming in because he's lost whatever momentum he had. He's also showing these interesting signals. I don't remember who it was who earlier, maybe it was Ralph, who said that he was spotted in a fancy restaurant in D.C. He's been visiting zoos. He loves animals and has been visiting a couple of zoos while he's been out and around and made a point of visiting some historic landmarks. Well, and he's not paid some of his staff. People are beginning to bleed from his organization again. You add all of this up and you say it becomes increasingly a joke. He hurts his credibility and his future potential earnings because if he becomes just a joke, he's not. I mean, he's at risk now of not even being a spoiler anymore.
Bob Hines, go ahead.
He's becoming a Harold Stassen and doing it all in one election.
Really?
Took Stassen several elections.
That's what happens when you have multiple lives in the same election.
Yeah. And, you know, he's doing something else, too. Certainly, among a lot of senior Republicans around the country, he's messing things up. He's ruining his own reputation for being a smart guy and knowing how to play the game, and he's probably making a lot of people take another look at him and say, you know, this guy is totally out for his own ego. He's not helping the party at all. I suspect that feeling is beginning to grow.
Is that something that the state parties are going to take a look at, and is that going to hurt him in other states? I mean, the stats I love are how many delegates he would have to win to get the nomination. The last I heard last night was that even if he were to win tonight, Newt Gingrich would still have to win 90% of the total electorate count to win in Tampa. Are the state parties taking notice of this, do you think, Carl?
I think they might. I think they might be. The other thing is that there's a new rule in the Republican Party that you have to carry either three or five states to even be in contention at the convention to be a nomination. So that is, he's not going to get there at this point. So he'll have his delegates. And he'll be able to wheel and deal with the delegates if it comes to that. But he really will have very little power at the convention. The big thing is, will they let him speak? And if they're really angry at him, if the state parties are really angry at him, they're liable to say you can't be on the podium. You can't speak because you're going to mess us up.
Bob Hines, you were a parliamentarian for a couple of the Republican conventions. Do you let somebody like a Newt Gingrich take a spotlight on the podium at the convention in Tampa?
Well, my guess is if he keeps up playing in the primaries and not getting any place and not winning many, if any, delegates, I think what's going to happen is you're going to discover that he may get a podium place on Monday morning, and Ron Paul will have an evening opportunity.
Congressman Al,
yeah,
go ahead, Al.
No, go ahead.
Alan Moore, go ahead.
I agree with Bob there that there's a lot of podium time. But there's only a limited amount of good podium time. So the key is to be able to have a spot where you might have a few people watching. And Gingrich is quickly moving to a point where if he has an opportunity, it will, as Bob says, be in the morning. It'll be sometime when a handful of people are watching. But more to the point, he risks harming his future ability to earn money because if you're just if you become a laughingstock or somebody that has angered the party generally for hanging on and harming the candidate in the party, there can be a lot of anger that can affect somebody in the future.
Congressman Al, go ahead.
Yeah, Alan. Yeah, I think that the Republican Party's got a couple of people to worry about. One is Ron Paul, and it seems to me that they're going to have to let him speak because his essential purpose is to try to get his message out. And if they let him get his message out at the convention, which would probably do them a little harm, even though it's very strange ideas, he probably will be a good boy and not run in a general. If they stiff him and he doesn't get a chance to get his message out, he might well run as a third party in order to deliver the message. Gingrich, on the other hand, having teed everybody off, I think they can dismiss him with very little danger of a flashback on them.
But I don't think that, this is Bob, I don't think that, to touch on the Ron Paul question, my guess is that Ron Paul is not going to be an independent candidate if he's well treated at the convention. One of the factors is his son is a senator, and I am sure that he'd like his son to have a good and successful career. And this is his chance to show that there's a legitimate part of the party that is libertarian and has those viewpoints, but we're still part of the Republican Party.
Yeah, but Bob,
that means...
Bob, it always seems that, you know, when we look at, you know, how Ron Paul has been treated, they've always given him a little bit of the respect, but it's always been the, you know, oh, he's just the crazy uncle on the fringe that we talk about and put in the recliner at Thanksgiving. It almost seems that they give him just, you know, 10 minutes on the podium, go ahead, and, oh, isn't that adorable, everybody, Ron Paul. Are they going to treat him that way again, or is there going to be a serious request from Ron Paul to say, I do my time, you better give me that podium?
Well, if I had to guess right now, and I don't, but I will anyway, I would guess the following, that what's going to happen is he'll get a reasonably good time to speak, and he will talk about the good ideas that our nominee has. And how that, you know, how this guy is a good conservative and has good views, and he's a good solid guy, and we can all support Romney. That's what I think he's going to do. I mean, it's pretty clear that in the last few months, he and Romney have developed some kind of a rapport, and he has gone out of his way to avoid taking shots at Romney, where he's been feeling relatively comfortable taking shots at other candidates. So I think that Paul is going to be helpful to Romney rather than hurt him, and I think he'll get a good opportunity to talk about it at the convention.
I agree with Bob, and I think the other thing you see with Paul is that he's just kind of running out of steam and energy. It's hard to do what these guys are doing. Traveling constantly and having to get up to give speeches and every day, all day, making decisions about what to do with resources and where to go here and what to do about this and what to do about that, and it does wear you down. And from early on, Paul said he didn't see himself running as a third party, and part of that has to do with money and energy and so on. So I think I agree with Bob. He has shown a bunch of signs in recent months of being very aggressive towards Santorum, somewhat dismissive of Gingrich, and has been inclined to say some positive things about Romney. And I think that there's a chance that he could be somewhat helpful to Romney. It's not guaranteed because he's his own guy, and he's going to, he's not going to read somebody else's speech. But I think that's a chance they'll be willing to take to kind of use him in the hope that he's helpful.
Carl Toobin.
When you look at some of the articles that were written about 4 or 5 weeks ago, they had Romney and Paul traveling together. I think Paul got on the Romney plane a couple of times to go different places. So there's a good relationship. Seems to be a good relationship there. And I think
that maybe your comments, Justin, were just a little bit off in saying that the party has been ignoring him. I think the media has been treating him the way you suggested the party had. I don't see a lot of evidence that the party has been dissing him. They've been treating him properly, but the media has been terrible. Another point I make about his age, I remember a wonderful story about Senator Magnuson as he was in the Senate, and he had to get up terribly early one morning, and he staggered out of bed and went over and pulled up the shade and staring right at a big billboard that said, "Go, go, go with Magnuson." And he said, "Oh, shit," and got dressed and set out for another day on the campaign trail.
Okay, first of all, family show, Al, that's your S-bomb for the week. Second of all, I can't tell you how much
he was quoting.
Missed. Yeah, that's true. He is quoting, so it is appropriate. The FEC didn't believe that, though. We missed the Maggie story.
Well, I'd like to count the number of 8-year-olds listening to this program.
I'd love to count anybody who was listening to this program. So, anyway, the reality goes, oh, come on, we know that all the media markets are listening to us. Hey, real quickly, when we look at the actual coming into the home stretch, particularly here in Illinois, it has been obvious that people are not prepping their candidates the way they should. We have Mitt Romney and Cheesy Grits. We have Rick Santorum yesterday saying, and please correct me if I'm wrong, he doesn't care about unemployment numbers. We've seen a number of blunders. Is this just a matter of they're tired and this is part of the problem of a prolonged campaign, or are we just really getting lazy in prepping our candidates? I'm going to start with you, Congressman Al.
I think that when you have to talk as much as a presidential candidate has to talk, it is inevitable that they're going to say something dumb somewhere along the line, and I think you just tack it up to being human and move on.
Bob Hines, what do you think?
I think much the same thing. You know, people take, for example, the Santorum comment is just one line. You know, I don't care about the unemployment. He was saying, I don't care about unemployment. That's not the real problem. The real problem is getting the economy going, basically. So if you read the whole quote, it's not nearly as quote, stupid, unquote. And, you know, every opponent looks for, you know, one-liners they can use in ads, but so often they are, you know, they may be effective, but they also are not quite what the person said who is being knocked around the corner. I think it's, you know, it's not that serious.
And besides, Romney said much the same thing a few weeks ago.
Very true. Very true. And they both pretty much said the same thing about, they both had some pretty serious blunders down in Puerto Rico. I guess, Alan Moore, when we look at the blunders, is it the fact that we've gotten lazy in preparing our candidates, or is this just battle fatigue?
You know, I'm amused at the notion, just the construct, have we gotten lazy about preparing our candidates? Like, who is the we that we're talking about? They have, you know, some of them have bigger staff, some have smaller staffs, but ultimately it's the candidate who's in charge. It's the candidate who calls the shots. It's the candidates who prepare before particularly major points like debates. But after a while, they get into a rhythm, and you can't have a full-blown practice session before every appearance that you make, every TV show, whatever. They will try to be up to date, say, what's the latest? What's a hot issue here locally? But as these guys have said, You also want to sound somewhat spontaneous, somewhat authentic, and we know Santorum's mind is going a mile a minute, and he's prone to show that in statements that he makes. And I think his statement and in the actual quote was, that what matters is freedom. And then he said, I don't care what the unemployment rate's going to be. Doesn't matter to me. And those were his words. And then he went on and had to then further explain it because he was questioned about it. He said, well, government doesn't create jobs. Presidents don't create jobs. We need an environment of freedom and free action, and that's what will free up the economy and so on. But in the meantime, here was this quote. Now, that wasn't the worst quote ever, but it was not a good quote. It was not helpful, and it was right in the heart. It was yesterday in Illinois with the primary today, coming on the heels of the embarrassing statements and the embarrassing loss in Puerto Rico. So, you know, this thing is up and down and up and down, and you got momentum, and then you take some hits. I don't think it's a matter of some magical preparation and some team that's somehow brilliantly in charge of everything. There are times, and you usually see it in debates, where somebody just isn't prepared, ready for prime time. We saw that with Rick Perry early on, and he did serious damage to himself and could never recover from it. These guys are much more practiced and so on, but they'll still stick their foot in it, some more than others.
Is the media, Carl, putting too much emphasis on the gaffes as opposed to the content?
Well, you know, I was just going to bring up the
You know, I don't think there's a single campaign that I can ever remember that there wasn't that every major player didn't have a gaffe at one time or another. There's more opportunity to catch them these days. There's more reporting of it. There's more television of it. There's Twitters and tweets and all this kind of stuff. So it gets around faster. But there've always been, you know, tired candidates who make a mistake. And it is
Mitt Romney's dad was a victim of one.
Yeah.
When he said I was brainwashed over Vietnam, and somebody took it literally rather than figuratively, as he mentioned it, and it's given credit for blowing him out of the race. Yep.
Well, when we absolutely take a hard look at what's going on in the race today, there's five things. Our friends at Politico have come up with the five things to look at in the Illinois primary. One is the fact that you've got Newt on vapors right now. He's not going to get any momentum out of Illinois. But the big thing continues to be that the limits of Santorum and how he's been able to wear his religion on his sleeve, come out and pretty much say that English has got to be a primary language in a place like Puerto Rico. He's really come out and either playing immediately to the strong hardcore base, or is this getting some traction? Alan Moore, let me go to you on that. Is this in fact getting traction, or is he just playing to the extreme in the base, hoping that that'll re-energize a fledgling campaign at this point?
You know, I it's funny watching him because he got very offended yesterday with Morning Joe, former Congressman Joe Scarborough, who's got a TV morning show, and they said, "Why are you?" And they're old friends; they served in the House together. And why are you talking about contraceptives? Why are you telling us all of that? And Santorum got very distressed and offended, and he said, I'm not always talking about it. People ask me about it, I tell them what I think. They expect to get an answer, but you guys are the ones who keep talking about it. And he got angry about that. And then they said, well, what? Yesterday he also was asked, this is on a talk show, on one of the Sunday shows, about his comment that he wants to get rid of hardcore pornography, and he took on the Justice Department for its failure to enforce current law. And saying, why are you talking about pornography when what's on people's mind is the economy? So, hey, people write me questions. I give them answers. That's what we do. And I posted it on my website. I didn't start talking about it. You guys started talking about it. he is constantly finding himself tempted and lured into answering questions that are totally off message, and then spending huge amounts of time trying to explain what he really meant and why that's not what he's talking about, and trying to turn it around on the press. It takes an enormous amount of discipline to do this stuff, and he still doesn't have it. He still operates, you know, his operation is bigger than Gingrich's, but it's still a very small shoestring, relatively speaking, operation, the weaknesses of which show up in state after state, where he doesn't have a full slate of delegates, which is the case in Illinois, it was the case in Ohio. He didn't get on the ballot in Virginia. I mean, these things all are tied together. You don't have the operation that can get you on these ballots. You don't have the group of people around that can help you stay on message and stay disciplined. And it takes practice. This is his first time at this in the national sphere.
Ralph Winnie.
But he's not able to take that to the next level where he can win a lot of these crucial stakes. In Hawaii, he finished second, but he could have done a whole lot better if he had had a really strong organization on the ground. What was very surprising was how terribly Newt Gingrich did. He didn't get any delegates in a state like Hawaii, where he had established relations with the Hawaii Republican Party, had been the Lincoln-based speaker for several years, and had developed relations in the state. So it was a major shock for him not to pick up any delegates, and it shows that Newt Gingrich really is on his way out.
Congressman Al, do you agree with that? Is, in fact, this the final stand for Gingrich?
Is this the final stand? I'm asking you. Is this the final stand of Gingrich? Al's phone is giving him trouble.
Wait a minute. Am I keeping Congressman Al awake?
No, his phone is giving him trouble. He's trying to get it to operate. Yeah, he's
I love live radio. Bob Hines,
yeah.
Let me go to you. We just heard Ralph talking about the last stand and the disappointment in Hawaii. And you would have thought that would have been a place that would have gotten Newt Gingrich motivated to go out and visit and spend time. This is the end of it for Newt?
I don't know if it's the end of it or not, because he is caught up in himself, I think, quite a bit. And I think Alan is correct. I think the amount of money he has in his bank account for the campaign is about the amount of money that he owes bills on right now. But, so the question is, how is he going to be able to operate in the future? I think it's going to be very difficult. I think Alan is right. But I also think that Gingrich's ego is so so significant a part of who he is, I don't think that he can go quietly into that night. I just don't think he's capable of making a graceful exit.
And is Congressman Al, I guess, is having some problems. Carl Tooven, as a former Democratic Party chair, if this is happening in your party, are you on the phone right now to headquarters saying, hey, look, something's got to end this?
Well, I think I would. I mean, you can't tell a person to get out of a race, but I think I might strongly suggest what we've said before, and that is that you're hurting the party, you're hurting yourself, and you're going to hurt the whole process, and could hurt us in the fall. And for those reasons,
yes,
and the fact
yes.
that it doesn't look like you're going to win anyplace else, I would really, really try to convince him to leave the race.
Well,
I mean, the next big race is going to be Wisconsin, and
right.
and that could be the one they were talking. That could be the one that would really give Mitt Romney a big boost if he wins today, and then if he wins in Wisconsin. Today he's going to win delegates. The big question is he going to get 49%, 50%, 55%, 51%, whatever it's going to be.
Well, let's go around the table on this. Congressman Al, does Romney win by over 50% today?
Justin, Al is still trying to make his phone operate.
Bob Hines, does Mitt Romney win 50% today?
If he doesn't hit 50% today, he's going to be awful close to it. I think he'll probably get to 50%. I feel it right now. I think that not that he has done anything so spectacular recently, but I think that Santorin has kind of messed himself up a little bit.
Alan Moore.
I think he falls short of 50, but he gets close. He can beat. You know, if he gets 48 and he beats Santorum by 10, that leaves 20%+ for Gingrich and Paul. That's my hunch. But if he does break, I think 50 is an interesting psychological point. If he can beat 50. That's a huge win for him. He does, like all these things, he needs to win. Indications are he will win reasonably comfortably. If he didn't, that would be huge for Santorum, but I think he falls short of 50.
Going to Dr. Ralph Winnie.
I think more and more people are resigning themselves to the fact that Romney is going to be the eventual nominee. But I still think it's going to be very close, and he just falls under 50.
And Carl Toobin?
I would, you know, because of the fact that he's leading in the polls in the large population areas,
he's going to
reach 50 or 51.
And then around the table one more time, does Newt, in fact, get out and announce he's leaving the campaign trail today or tomorrow? Starting with you, Alan Moore.
Not yet, but within 2 weeks.
And we've got a caller on the line. Let's go to that caller. Caller from the 727, you're on the air. 727, you're on the air. And 727, we'll put you back on hold. Congressman Al, does Newt Gingrich pull out today or tomorrow?
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Oh, wonderful. No.
Okay. And one last question. Do we see Ron Paul endorse Mitt Romney, and does he pull out after Illinois? Alan Moore?
Nope.
Bob Hines?
Nope.
Congressman Al?
Nope.
Carl Toobin?
Nope.
And Ralph Winnie?
No.
Okay.
I also think that Mr. Gingrich is going to do all he can to stay in this race, and we'll see what happens.
Very interesting. Again, we'll try the caller again. Caller on the 727, you're on with Backroom Politics.
Yeah, sorry about that earlier. I just wanted to comment. In regards to Rick Santorum, I think his biggest problem is he found himself in this spot that it was kind of just landed in his lap. He didn't really ascend to this position. There was no one left to turn to. I mean, his whole entire race, people were on, you know, with Herman Cain, and then they turned to Rick Perry, and they turned from Rick Perry to this person. I mean, he pretty much got to this position through battlefield promotion. I mean, everybody else quit, and there was never any energy behind him. And if there was another person to turn to, he'd be at 6 or 7% overnight. They turned to that other person, but there's nobody left.
So I take it you're not a big Santorum fan, caller.
I don't dislike the guy, but I mean. You know, honestly, if you brought some of these people back and it was Santorum versus Michelle Bachmann, the conservative base would pick Bachmann first, and they'd pick even Rick Perry probably over him. I mean, literally, he was the last. I mean, even Rick Perry was polling higher than Santorum up until the point he dropped out. I mean, there's nothing special about this guy other than he just couldn't stay in long enough.
Well, if you ask one of our panel members, Alan Moore, he'll tell you that there is something special. There's a really special Google entry on his name.
Yeah. I will remind the caller and everybody that Santorum is the guy who spent the most time in Iowa, and he, even though it took a while, he quote won unquote Iowa. He prevailed by some 35 votes with a couple hundred missing, but still, he started there. He was quiet. He worked that state hard, and suddenly, lo and behold, he won. You're absolutely right. All these flashes in the pan soared to the top and then went crashing down, and he was kind of the Energizer Bunny, tortoise versus these multiple hares, who just kept going. He's not a... You know, he's a guy of some substance, and he's pretty interesting in a lot of ways. And I worked with him when I worked in the Senate in the last decade, and found a lot of things about him that I personally liked, and felt that he was pushing hard on a number of not very popular issues, most particularly global health spending, AIDS and malaria and stuff, and not something that gained him a lot of currency back home. Worked behind the scenes, kind of a team player. He's been criticized for that. Having said all of that, he has also got some personal views and some political views that are so extreme and so out there that it gives a lot of people the creeps. And having said that, it's also something that appeals to some hardcore Republicans in the Republican base. And so he does have people who like him a lot. It's a small group, though. His popularity really is the evangelicals, the social Christians, some of the rural folks. And it's hard to see him breaking out, and he has not done well out of the South, although he came close in Michigan and Ohio. Again, low turnout and people who haven't warmed to Romney thought, if he's my option, I'll go for it.
Hey, Congressman Al, is basically what we're talking about here just a bottom line, pure, unadulteristic voter apathy at this point?
Had to swallow.
Are we taking you away from something more important?
No, it's not voter. What?
Are we taking you away from something more important, Congressman Al?
No, you're not. But if I had tried to answer it before I swallowed, I would have ruined this tie.
In other words, the answer is yes. I took you away from a much more important martini.
No, actually, it's just soda water at this point. But I'm waiting for the break, so hurry up and get us there.
And I'll give you the martini right now.
Let the record show that Al thinks enough of us, even on the telephone, that he wears a tie to the broadcast. Oh my God!
But he kept it clean. Al kept it clean. He didn't break any rules.
Back to the question, Al.
Now I've forgotten the question.
Oh, you know what? Oh, the heck with it. You know what? We're going to take a break. It's happy hour. I need alcohol. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio from Claremore, Oklahoma, by way of Washington, D.C. Oh, and by the way, Backroom Politics is sponsored by and wholeheartedly endorsed by Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be back in 3 minutes. And by the way, it's happy hour. Time to order your drinks. Time to order your cigars. It's time to take it to the home stretch. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Thank you.
we're back here live, kind of from Shelley's back room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Joining us as they do every Tuesday at this time is Dr. Ralph Winnie, Carl Tubin, the Honorable Alan Moore, Honorable Bob Hines, and the always entertaining Congressman Al Swift. I'm your host, J.T. Russell, radio talk show host. And by the way, we're going to change gears a little bit, talk about a little bit of Capitol Hill politics going on. In case you missed it, which apparently not many people did, Paul Ryan gave us his budget proposal. Here's the question for you, and Alan Moore, I'm going to start with you. Have you seen the budget proposal, and can you give us a little thumbnail of what's going on in Chairman Ryan's head?
Well, Chairman Ryan is doing what he has been doing since he's become Chairman Ryan, which is be pretty aggressive about trying to come up with plans to cut federal spending and cut taxes. And some of his proposals, he's a very smart guy who's got a pretty deep understanding of the budget and how things work. He's also got a respect among his colleagues and a good sense of their thinking. The problem is that when you talk about the kind of spending cuts that he talks about without any increase in taxes, there's a fundamental imbalance in the minds of many of the Democrats and outside observers and the mainstream press. So they tend to ridicule him and talk about a one-sided proposition, and yet a year ago he proposed a fundamental modification of the Medicare system. He basically said, we're going to get rid of Medicare the way it currently exists, and what we're going to do is we're going to give everybody who's eligible for Medicare, in effect, a stipend. You will get money, you will take that money, and you'll go buy private insurance. Well, it sounded very aggressive. It was ridiculed heavily politically by Democrats and outside observers. What he's done this time, well, in the intervening period, a number of legitimate folks who know a lot about health insurance and stuff said, you know, Ryan's idea goes too far, but it might not be a bad idea to give Medicare eligible persons an option. They can keep Medicare like they've got it now, or they can take a stipend and go out into the private sector, because it might be that people will be happier and government will – some people will be happier and government will pay less. And so there's, as I say, some bipartisan proposals to that effect. He's back again this time with cuts all over the place, including in Medicare, and I believe – I'm not certain on this particular issue – that he's modified his old proposal to promote it as an option rather than a take-it-or-leave-it proposition. The Democrats are loving it because they can say, here's what the Republicans are up to again. They're gonna renege on the deal we cut over the course of the last year and strike out again at middle-class programs that are lifeline to people and is proposing tax cuts rather than increases. It's not that the Senate's never going to buy this, whether it can pass the House or not, I don't know, but it is a reminder that he's a serious player willing to stick his neck and the necks, if you will, of his fellow Republicans in the House anyway on the line. But it is an acknowledgement that we've got serious problems in our economy with governmental deficits and so on. So,
Alan, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm just wondering if the on either the first or the second option, if they give people this money to buy health insurance, do they have to buy health insurance with that money?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you wouldn't be able to self-insure. And, of course, it's only for people over 65. So, in effect, it's to say if you're once you're eligible for Medicare, then you're going to have a choice of existing options available under Medicare. But you can also take a stated amount of money and go in a third direction to. Because there's really two options now in many places under Medicare, and go to private insurers who might get into this business and have a better option. So,
and I don't have a big problem with that, provided that they have to. What I is that you give them this money.
Yeah. No, you can't. You wouldn't
get
a
they
check.
Get sick and,
well, no. You would have the right to money that could only be spent for this particular purpose. I think he's also proposing he may be proposing. I'm not certain about this. To slowly increase the eligibility age for Medicare. Right now, it's the day you hit 65, you're eligible. But although I'm not sure that's part one of his proposals here. That's a proposal under the famous Simpson-Bowles commission. I better not attribute it now to Ryan because I'm just not sure.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Bob Hines. What out of what we know about the Ryan plan that was released today? This has got certain members of the leadership in the GOP a little bit torqued. What's torquing them?
What's what? I'm sorry?
What's getting some of the Republicans upset about Paul Ryan's budget plan? Is it that they didn't think of it first, or is it outside the box too much for the conventional thinking?
Well, you know, with respect to the and I'm drawing a blank on the senator's name from Wisconsin, who, as a Democrat, and he and Ryan together have worked on this this change in the original proposal last year with respect to Social Security. Is it Feingold?
Russ Feingold, Senator Russ Feingold.
Yeah, it's Feingold. And so you know, the change in the Medicare program, I think, is a bipartisan one on the part of both gentlemen.
Feingold is not in the Senate, guys.
Okay, then I'm wrong. Who is it? Alan, who is it?
Feingold was beaten by a guy whose name I've forgotten, and then Herbert Cole is the other one, and he's retiring.
Well, who is the senator from, if it is the Democratic senator who is working with Ryan on this Medicare change? I just can't think of his name.
Well, it's Ron Wyden of Oregon.
Ron Wyden, I'm sorry,
right.
You're right.
That's it.
Yes. I always call him my expert. Well, you know, to me, he's made a good change.
He's a great senator from Wisconsin, too.
Yeah.
Right.
To me, it's a good change that there is.
If he were from Wisconsin, he'd be a great senator from Wisconsin.
He'd be a great senator from Wisconsin. Okay, first of all, let's be clear. Number one, let's just get everybody back up to speed right now. Number one, Russ Feingold, a former senator of Wisconsin who arguably has come out against Paul Ryan and his proposals, not as a seated senator, but just as civilian, former Senator Russ Feingold. Also, it was Senator Wyden out of Oregon who was actually the senator coming out against that.
Yeah.
And Congressman Al seems to think that he would make a great senator from Wisconsin as well. So, now that we've gotten that cleared up,
Except we didn't quite clear it up because it's Wyden who has joined in a proposal that would create the Ryan-type proposal as an option for people when they become eligible for Medicare. It's the option of keeping it the way it is or purchasing in the private market a policy. So, and I don't remember who the Republican in the Senate is who's joined this proposal, but Paul Ryan has basically embraced the idea when over months ago when it came out. He said that's fine, that's consistent, and that's why I think that in his new proposal, he's open to that optional instead of required. Get rid of the old Medicare and simply buy a policy.
Right.
Yeah, if I were in Congress now as a Democrat, I would take the position that that's a good place to start. I think shooting it down out of hand is irresponsible, and some Democrats will try to do that. But I'm sure there are all kinds of things in his proposal I would like to change, but I don't think that the overall description you've made is outrageous at all. I think it's worth working on.
Is that something that is too far out of the box for conventional GOP thinking, Bob?
Well, I'm not sure what conventional GOP thinking is right now, given the fact that the Tea Party...
Or that there is any, for that matter.
Now, Al.
But
I think it's... I think as Alan said, it's a good place to start. It's a better approach than last year, and I think what it does is it requires the Democrats not to just attack the program, but to talk about, okay, if you don't like that, what do you want? I mean, the fact of the matter is, and I don't think anybody really disagrees with the concept that Medicare, as we know it, can stay forever. The cost is too great. We have too many new people coming into the program and too few people in the next generation putting money into the program. So the fact of the matter is we're going to have a problem. And long term, we have to solve that problem because we want to make sure that Medicare continues. And this approach gives an opening for both parties to try to find some solutions here. And I think from that standpoint, it's good to see something like that being done with members of both sides of the political spectrum joining together with respect to a Medicare proposal. I think it's a big plus.
Alan, if that's the conventional or the lack of conventional thinking on the GOP part, what's got some of the other side of the aisle torqued about the Paul Ryan? One, the fact that it came from a member of leadership in the Republican Party. What else has got the Dems torqued up about this?
Oh, listen, he wants to cut a couple of trillion dollars out of the deficit in coming years. It's a very aggressive scheme to cut spending. There's a small increase for defense, but he whacks the entitlements and he whacks spending across the board. That's what's got them torqued out. And there are I think there's some tax reform, but tax reform that allows the cutting of the top rates. And I think he also simplifies the tax system. There are now five different rates. He would cut it to two different rates: a 10% and a 25% rate, simplifying. Wiping out, needless to say, a bunch of deductions, and then reducing the top rate, but not raising net new revenue in the process, which of course is a very controversial issue with Democrats or with some outside economists and so on.
There's plenty of controversy here. Okay.
The figure that was mentioned this morning was $5 trillion over a period of years.
Well, let's look at this. When we look at Congressman now, Chris Van Hollen was talking about it this morning, and he was talking about, and he says, quote, they can run, but they can't hide from their Medicare plan, which ends the Medicare guarantee. At the same time, they're providing big new tax breaks to millionaires and protecting special interest tax loopholes. That just sounds like the same Democratic rhetoric that we've heard every time a new proposal's come out of the budget committee. Is Representative Van Hollen being fair to the budget, or is in fact he on target? Congressman Al. Did we lose Congressman Al again, Bob?
I don't think Al. Go ahead. Can you hear Al?
Can't hear
Al.
Get out here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Congressman Al.
We can't hear him. Do we want to hear him?
I don't know if we want. You know what? I'll go to you, Alan. Alan, did you hear the question?
Repeat it, please.
Chris Van Hollen out of Maryland, Democrat, said they can run, but they can't hide from their Medicare plan, which ends the Medicare guarantee at the same time they're providing big new tax breaks to millionaires and protecting special interest tax loopholes. Chris Van Hollen, Democrat out of Maryland, is he just saying the same rhetoric that we've heard every time there's been a budget proposal coming out of the GOP, or does he have some traction on this?
Well, it's deja vu all over again. This was the reaction a year ago to the Ryan plan, which was more aggressive. So it's no surprise whatsoever to hear it again. It remains to be seen whether the House will choose to pass it or decide, you know, something, we don't have to pass it. The Senate's not going to pass it. We think it might hurt us.
Al, we got you back online, it looks like.
Right.
You've got me? Yeah, we do. Congressman, now we have you back. So I'm going to ask you again. You know, we've been hearing a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of the same rhetoric as Alan Moore.
And I've heard the question, and I'm ready to answer. Senator Ben Allen is the chairman of the House Democratic Campaign Committee. This is standard Democratic campaign rhetoric. And so it doesn't surprise me in that regard whether or not this is going to actually be the Democrats' position or not remains to be seen, but I would hope it is not.
Why is that, Al? Why do you hope that it's not?
I hope it's not because there's got to be on our side as well as on the Republican side. There are a variety of suggestions that have been made for handling Social Security as well as Medicare and Medicaid that are not outrageous. They are transitional. They give people plenty of time to prepare, so forth and so on. And they conclude with some reduced expenditures. And I think that's as important for the Democrats to recognize as it is for the Republicans to recognize we're going to need some more revenue.
Is this a budget proposal that can actually win over public support and win over bipartisan, even a little bit support on the Hill, Bob Hines?
Well, I think this proposal by Ryan is likely to get support on Capitol Hill from at least in the House of Representatives. I think it. I wouldn't be surprised if it didn't pass the House and went nowhere in the Senate. If what Mr. Van Hollen is saying is what is going to be the Democratic position, there'll be no budget because the Democrats in the Senate have already said that the president's budget is dead, that they're not going to do anything about it. Their view is that the budget deal they cut last year has some automatic cuts starting next January is all the budget they need, and as far as they're concerned, they're closed.
One of the things that I think you need to consider is, has the recent recess over the summer and what have you, has that changed the minds of any incumbents, Republican or Democrat, about the fact that people are just getting fed up with doing nothing? And does that soften positions? I really don't know. I do know, and I hope we talk a little bit about this later on, that some of the retirements from Congress suggest people are throwing up their hands and saying, screw this, I'm not going to spend my time sitting around here listening to all this bickering.
Well, I mean, going to Alan Moore, Alan, hearing all of this, is there a possibility, I mean, can this country afford to go through, even now going into a third year of a continuing resolution without a sustainable budget in place?
Well, there is a budget in place. It's not the regular order budget. It's not the kind of system that was devised in 1974 when they passed the Congressional Budget Act and hoped that by May 15 there would be a jointly agreed upon budget for the year. But every year, by one way or the other, we appropriate funds. There was, last August was the big Budget Control Act agreement that said, we're either going to here's our spending caps for this year, and we're going to agree that we're going to cut another $1 trillion starting in the fiscal year 2013, the year that begins October 1st of this year, and if we don't come up with a particular way to do it, we'll automatically cut half out of defense and half out of domestic spending over the next 10 years. And this is the sort of disaster scenario that the Secretary of Defense has talked about, and a lot of Republicans in the Senate, a disaster in terms of too much cutting of the defense budget on top of agreed cuts already, and with others saying, oh my gosh, you're going to do serious damage to a variety of domestic spending programs. We have a budget. It's not a nice, clean, crisp, by-the-rules budget, but every year, sort of by definition, because we spend and we have a deficit and it's agreed to and passed the Congress, we do end up with what I would call a budget, even though it's far from the kind of process that we anticipated and that we would most like.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to let that be the last word on this. We're going to keep an eye on the budget battle, obviously, on the Hill. When we come back, I want to talk about some contentious redistricting bloodbaths that are happening. In particular, I want to talk about, I believe it's Illinois 14, where two incumbents are going head-to-head in a Republican primary today, one that has got minority whip McCarthy really, really, really angry at Majority Leader Eric Cantor. This is Backroom Politics Live from, well, kind of from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, by way of Oklahoma, Maryland, and the Commonwealth of Virginia. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Hey, Al.
Down, 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 down
we're back live from Claremore, Oklahoma, by way of Washington, D.C., and Maryland, and the great state of, or the great Commonwealth of Virginia. This is Backroom Politics live from, live on Blog Talk Radio. And with us, as always, is Alan Moore, Bob Hines, Congressman Al Swift, and Carl Tubin. Folks, here's the great thing about it is we want to talk a little bit about what's going on in a heated House race. There's actually a lot of heated House races going on right now, but in particular, there's one out in Illinois where a Republican, Don Manzullo, is facing another Republican Congress member, Adam Kinzinger, out in Illinois, and that race is going on today. But apparently, Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, has come out and embraced the rookie Kinzinger against the veteran Manzullo. This has got a lot of people upset, to the point where Cantor followed up and gave a $52,000 advertisement buy to Kinzinger. Number one, this has created a huge bloodbath in Illinois, and obviously this is going to have some effects in how the young guns and the Republican leadership are perceived. But let's start off, Bob Hines. Traditionally, in a Republican race, whether it's two or six, leadership has kind of stayed out of it and let them fall for themselves. Why would Eric Cantor go against that grain, or is this nothing unusual?
Well, number one, in my experience, it's quite unusual. I'm not sure exactly what's going on, but it's caused a rift within the Republican leadership. Normally, in a case like this, everybody sticks to town, and lets the two, you know, unfortunately, when you get one district and two members running for it, one of them is going to lose. You've got the situation where, you know, you can't win by getting on one side or another, unless you have some maybe some ulterior motives. I'm not sure, but usually people, the leadership or everybody stays out of things like this. Lets the fight go on and then is happy with who won, but the leadership does not take sides on the issue. This is very unusual.
And Congressman Al, you've been in Congress. You've had several races, one even in a redistricting. This obviously shocks you that Eric Cantor, the majority leader, would come out and do a move like this.
Well, it shocks me. Now, I do remember that John Dingell was in a race with a much younger, very liberal, and apparently a very good congresswoman, but she was like two or three terms. He was, of course, the dean of the House. And Nancy Pelosi, who was not the leader at the time, but she backed the non-Dingell candidate. And I kept thinking at the time, you know, if you go after the king, you better get him. And she didn't. Now, that didn't keep her from being speaker, but Dingell is still there. So,
well, when Alan, in your experience, you're seeing this. Does this take away from the credibility of not only Cantor and his endorsement capabilities, but also does this take away some of the power of the young guns?
Well, let's see how the day plays out, right? I think Al makes a very good point. If you're going to get into one of these, you want to be on the winning side. Former Speaker Pelosi has weighed in a couple of cases in California where there's sitting congressmen against each other. It's an unusual circumstance for sitting congressmen to battle it out, and so there aren't a lot of precedents where this even comes up. It has to come up immediately after a redistricting, and that only happens every 10 years. And then it has to be a situation where two members of the same party find themselves in the same district. We talked a week or so ago about Dennis Kucinich losing his race to Marcy Kaptur up in Ohio. Sometimes I think leaders decide, you know something, we're just going to sit on the sidelines and watch. What I think Cantor has said in this particular case is, hey, this guy Kinzinger is one of my guys. I have supported him throughout. I've committed myself to him months ago. No big surprise, nothing new. The other leaders have sat it out. I don't see a huge rift here. I think that gets overblown. Cantor's going to let his other guys. Is not going to surprise anybody here. The money, the $52,000 went from the super PAC that these young guns have created. It's not Cantor's money per se, which isn't to say he doesn't have some considerable say over it. That's not clear to me. But at the end of the day, one of these guys will win if it is neck and neck, and if Cantor's candidate, the young gun Kinzinger, wins, then Cantor wins. In effect, it's like, hey, he rolled the dice and he came out. If Manzullo, who's closed the gap of just the last few weeks to make it a real toss up, if he should prevail, that creates a real messy environment inside the Republican caucus, and I think that's what Al was accurately referring to before, when Nancy Pelosi rolled the dice, went with the much younger female candidate against the old bull, John Dingell, and then Dingell prevailed. You can bet to this day, John Dingell remembers that and doesn't mind every now and then, if he doesn't have his fingerprints on it, dinging former Speaker Pelosi.
Well, you know, it's
if funny. If I were Pelosi, I would have hired a food taster at that point.
It's funny too, because when we look at the rundown on this, obviously Manzullo called the Speaker's office just furious, and apparently Speaker Boehner gave $52,000 in fair trade out of his PAC. Does this put the Speaker in an awkward position, Bob?
Well, sure it does. I mean, the leadership. The leadership wants to have the caucus as unified as possible. That's just by definition. And we have a particularly difficult situation today in the Republican House because the young guns are so eager to get additional cuts in spending. And and sometimes they go beyond what is politically possible, but they want to do it anyway. So it's a problem. I think that we're going to have a problem continuously. This is going to resonate through the caucus a little bit. There's no doubt about it in my mind. And I don't know, I don't know the details, and I guess it's hard to know what they are. But I think Alan is right that this is one of the guys who Kinzinger is one of the guys who, very early on, Cantor identified as a really up-and-comer, and he won a seat, and he is a very bright young guy, and he may have made commitments, that he's now honoring, and that's causing a drift within the leadership.
But let me.
There's also the point.
All right, hold on. Congressman Al, go ahead.
Okay. But if we've got a problem in the Congress between Republicans and Democrats who can't get along on even what time of day it is, then if we start dividing up the parties in the same way, this dysfunctional Congress is going to fall apart altogether. John Boehner is a weak speaker in the sense that he hasn't got strong support. I think he's a very strong speaker in terms of ability, but he's got a lot of people that are not, you know, great Boehner fans. And if civil war breaks out within the Republican Party, and I think there's a possibility of a similar thing occurring with the Democrats, particularly with the new Democrats coming in after the election, Congress is going to be in pretty bad shape.
Well, you know, it's funny because, I mean, this is not the only race where this is going to come into play. You've got old bulls or old school versus new school races down in Louisiana, Bussani and Landry. You've got Florida, my old district seat, Florida 14. You've got Micah and Sandy Adams squaring off. And then you look at Arizona and Phoenix, you've got Quayle and Schweikert. At some point, this is going to be old versus new. Who has the most to lose from this, Boehner or Cantor? Let me start with you, Alan.
I'm sorry, who
has the most to lose by backing old versus new or actually taking it out of the box?
Does Cantor have
the most to lose?
Cantor's the one who has put his neck out here, so he has the most to lose and the most to win. I mean, Boehner, I had not heard the report that Boehner had matched the pack giving. I don't even know that he's got that kind of a pack. What I had read was that Boehner had given the equal amount of money to both of these guys. But Cantor's the one who has stuck his neck out. He is the one who has the most to win, the most to gain, and the most to lose. If he should lose this one and Manzullo wins, then he has got to immediately go to Manzullo and say, let me tell you what I did. Let me tell you why I did it. Let me tell you how much I love you and how much I want to work with you. And Manzullo will nod and say, you know, fine, they'll work something out, but Manzullo will never trust him again. You know, that's not a position that Cantor wants to be in on the one hand. On the other hand, Cantor's got, you know, 100 young guys, and he needs to show them that his deeds follow his words, that he supports them and he will fight for them. It's a really interesting and unusual situation.
Now, one of the interesting...
Carl, go ahead.
You know, a lot of this has been the history of the last 2 years. And, you know, Eric Cantor is very aggressive, and he wants more power. And, you know, there was a whole thing about he and Boehner kissing and making up and all this, but there's still an undertow there, underlining distrust. And I think this is for the future. He's trying to, again, you're right, he's trying to show his people, you can count on me. But in certain races, he's trying to get his people in and other people out.
Bob Hines, go to you on this one. We did see yesterday, once this broke, Manzullo actually calling for Cantor to resign as majority leader, citing that this is out of place for leadership. If, in fact, Manzullo does win, and again, it's anybody's call right now, does this cause Cantor to lose majority leader?
No, I don't believe it. I don't believe that it would cause him to be removed as majority leader. Not at all. I don't think that would happen. But there would be a rift in the caucus between more senior members and the Tea Party members that would be difficult to it would probably add to the uncomfortableness within the caucus of trying to come to strong united positions, because you know they're looking up at the at the speaker, and they're looking up at the whip, and they're looking up at the majority leader, and they're not all together.
Congressman Al, I want to go to you on this one. Does this, if Manzullo were to win, and again, this is a big if, does this give the speaker a little bit more of a bigger stick to swing and saying, okay, playtime's over, everybody get in line, and if you don't, you're going to feel the big stick?
It gives him a little edge in that regard. It doesn't give him all the power your question implies. But I think it does, if Manzullo loses, Cantor's march on the speakership is increased measurably. If he loses this, the speaker is more secure than he is right now. But it's all on the margins, because I don't think, I agree with Bob, it will be a killer kind of a reaction.
And so let me go to you, Alan. Who's the big winner in this? Or is it just a matter of we'll see when the polls close?
There will be no big winner. The big winner will be whoever between these two guys becomes the Republican candidate. He'll be the big winner. If it's Cantor's guy, it's a, as Al says, it's a marginal gain for him. If Manzullo prevails, it's a marginal loss for Cantor. I don't think it may make them very hesitant. Either way, no matter what happens, I think this experience is going to make Cantor and everybody else very cautious about the other three Republican versus Republican races that are coming up.
Congressman Al, you agree with that?
I think that's basically sound. I think it is going to spread, however, suspicion within the conference that will be on both sides. I don't see how Cantor comes out of this in a better position with the old dogs. And I don't think that if he wins, I think if he wins, he gains more than he would otherwise. But if he loses, I think he doesn't lose that much. But there's going to be, I've always thought of Cantor as the guy in the corner with the lean and hungry look. And I think
I don't even know what that means.
Well, John Cassius has a lean and hungry look. He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous.
You need to read your Shakespeare, specifically Julius Caesar, and particularly the character of Cassius. But he really is. This is something you don't do if you're not incredibly ambitious, it seems to me.
This is Bob. This is exactly, I was thinking as this conversation many-sided goes on, I was thinking exactly of the same couplet from Julius Caesar about Cassius in a mean and hungry look. And you know, it is true that the gentleman from Richmond has had that look about him for some time, and it's been a reality within the Republican caucus. It's been a reality within the leadership, and it's been something that members are very much aware of, and this only exacerbates that problem.
Bob, is this a changing of the guard?
I certainly don't. If it is, I think we're in for an even more difficult time than we have been over the last few years, because Mr. Cantor is not nearly as much willing to negotiate and find solutions than Mr. Boehner is.
Alan Moore, you want to say something?
And that's not to criticize necessarily. It's to just state that he has a different philosophy.
Alan Moore.
He has, however, shown a number of efforts in the last 6 months or so to put on a more approachable, more human normal kind of face. He's brought his family out into the public a little bit. I will remind everybody that the opening part of that Shakespeare quote goes like this: "Let me have men about me who are fat, sleek-headed men, such as sleep at night. Yond Cassius has a lean and hungry look. He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous." I think that's the sort of the full quote. So, let me have men about me who are fat. That's sort of the key intro line here that we don't want to forget.
Guess what? We're covered on that one. Ha! I'm your mother. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to do Tell Me a Story, but we're also going to talk about Joe Biden and the most audacious plan ever executed by man in 500 years. We're going to talk about it. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. And by way of Claremore, Oklahoma, Maryland, Virginia, we're all over the place today. Real quickly,
Dick Jason.
What's that?
Before you get started on a new topic, I want to note that I hate people who can quote more than two consecutive lines of Shakespeare.
I want to, on record, as the moderator.
You have to hate me.
As moderator, I'm going to tell you, I will tell you, that'll probably be the last time we have more than two lines of Shakespeare on this show.
Jason?
Yeah.
I just want to make one comment about the last discussion. you all are presupposing that the Tea Party and the Republicans will prevail in November. And I don't think that's a sure bet.
Oh, you want to put a little bit of money on that one, Mr. Turvin?
The name is Tuvin, and I don't bet on politics.
That's a man who's been around the world.
There we go. Hey, real quickly, we're going to talk a little bit. We're going to have a little bit of fun here before we go into Tell Me a Story. We're going to spend a couple of minutes talking about yesterday at a fundraiser, Vice President Joe Biden, who, in my view, the best vice president ever, talked about the most audacious plan in 500 years being Barack Obama's decision to raid the Osama bin Laden compound in Abbottabad in Pakistan. So our friends at Politico, namely Tim Mak, came up with, hey, Joe, there's other audacious plans that's happened over 500 years you might have forgotten about. Not taken away. It was a ballsy move. But let's look at some other ballsy moves that have happened. They talk about D-Day, the Normandy landings in 1944, Napoleon's invasion of Russia. First of all, I think everybody's in agreement. D-Day is definitely a really audacious plan in 500 years. Wouldn't everybody agree?
Yeah.
Would indeed.
We would.
Okay.
Don't forget General Washington crossing the Delaware River and attacking the Hessians and turning the damn war around and saved the young country that was growing.
Well, let's go through the list first, but let's go through the list and we'll talk about what's missing. They also talk about Napoleon's invasion of Russia, the raid on Entebbe by IDF forces in Uganda, the Spanish Armada sailing towards England, the landing in Incheon by Douglas MacArthur.
MacArthur.
They also talk about number six is Operation Eagle Claw, which was it was an audacious move, but this was Eagle Claw that was supposed to rescue the Americans at the embassy in Tehran. The capture of Adolf Eichmann, General Pickett's charge, the landings at Gallipoli, and a really obscure one, the raid at Cabin Atuan, which is the 300 soldiers and Filipino guerrillas took place and took Allied POWs back from the Japanese Imperial Army. Just out of curiosity, I want to go around the table. Hey, Alan Moore, we'll start with you. What's missing from this?
Well, two things. One, what audacious makes? Well, what I think is pretty audacious is his comment. What I have two things I wonder about. What happened 501 years? What happened was, what was it 501 years ago that was even more audacious? That's the first question. And secondly, I just find it really curious that Biden himself has admitted that when it came down to decision time in the White House as to whether to do this, Biden's advice was not yet.
Oh, very interesting point. Congressman Al, any thoughts on this list?
Yeah, I think Harry Truman got left out of this on two counts.
Right.
One, he fired MacArthur, which was profoundly unpopular in this country. And two, he made a decision that is still debated, and that's to drop the atomic bomb in Japan.
Right.
And that was audacious.
That is audacious. I will give you that.
Yeah.
How about you, Bob Hines? What's missing from this?
Well, I think we probably hit most of the ones I can think of that are audacious, and I would again respond as I did earlier. I think Washington and crossing the Delaware on Christmas Eve, and basically saving the revolution, literally saving the revolution we were going. Was probably the most audacious thing you could have possibly imagined, given the last 250 years and the rise of the United States, how significant it was.
Well, or the Declaration of Independence itself.
Yeah.
Indeed.
That too is true. How about, Carl, what do you think's missing from here?
Well, there was one little aspect of the Revolutionary War where General Washington had troops on in Brooklyn, and they all of a sudden were surrounded by British troops, and they would have wiped our people out completely. And in the dead of night on flatboats, he ran a ferry boat type situation where he got all the troops out of Brooklyn and over into New York City. And when the British woke up and went to fight the Americans, there weren't any.
That's right. The only thing that was left were a bunch of pizza parlors.
Whatever. Not that far back. Not that far back. But anyway, I agree with Al that the Truman move on the atom bomb was quite audacious. Some of his reasoning came out when he came out and said, "I didn't have to think a minute," etc. You know, that was Harry Truman, and that's he said it like it was, and that, what he thought.
Well, we got 6 minutes left, and I'm going to say something that I thought popped up yesterday, and I saw the article in our friends at Politico, and I thought, you know what, we could probably have fun with that. Hey, real quickly, it's coming up on 6 minutes to the end of the show. It's time for my favorite part, Tell Me a Story. This is where we talk about rumor, innuendo, and stuff just happening around the Beltway that we might be able to scoop some of the other media markets on. I'm going to go around the horn, starting with you, Congressman Al. Al, tell me a story.
Newt Gingrich will stay in the race to the very, very end, and when he loses ignominiously, he will announce that none of the other candidates and the American people simply can't understand big ideas. He will go down arrogant to the last.
Wow. Good one. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
There are two biographies of Senator Rubio of Florida coming out this year. Senator Rubio has written a story of his family's arrival in America, etc., that was due to come out in late October. The Washington Post reporter who wrote the story about his family arriving in America before Castro has written a biography about the senator. And Mr. Rubio has moved his date of publication earlier than that. The Washington Post story comes out about early July, and on the 19th of June, Senator Rubio's book is coming out. I think this means that he really is serious about, number one, getting his story out, and also he thinks he might be a vice presidential candidate.
Wow, that's a good one, Bob. Go around to Alan Moore. Alan, tell me a story.
Yeah, in 1960, Richard Nixon promised at the convention that he would visit all 50 states. And he, coming the last weekend before the election, had to go to Alaska because that was the only state he hadn't been to. It was a long trip to Alaska in those days. He went up there, and there was some payoff in Alaska because he won by a little over 1,000 votes and picked up all three electoral votes from Alaska. Having said that, historians believe that it was one of the biggest blunders and wastes of time in history because there were several other states that he also lost by about 1% that would have given him enough electoral votes to beat Kennedy. It's not clear that it would have happened, but I think that that Santorum's investment of time in Puerto Rico, the gaffes he made talking about how it needed to be an English-speaking state if it were going to join the Union, getting photographed sunbathing by the pool.
By the way, that's a picture I cannot get out of my head. I cannot get that vision out of my head.
It was, and the fact that he called himself while he was down there, he said, in the Senate I was known as Senator Puerto Riqueño. Well, it turned out that in this entire enterprise, he was more like Senator Embarazado. He humiliated himself. He was completely crushed, and I think that that if he loses big today in Illinois, he may look back and others may look back and say, spending time in Puerto Rico when I lost 90-10 approximately was one of the big blunders, and I think he may have peaked, and this may be the beginning of a very big change. We'll know a lot more tonight.
Wow. Carl Tuven.
Right. I was watching Letterman last night and was very impressed. The first lady came on, and David Letterman looked at her and said, you know, what do you all really, you know, there's couples have pillow talk, and, you know, what do you all talk about? And she said she didn't respond. And then he said, well, does he ever come in to the bedroom and say, that doggone John Boehner, blah, blah, blah? And everybody laughed, and she looked at Letterman straight in the eye and said, the president has the greatest respect for the Congress and John Boehner. The highest regard.
Awesome. Hey, this is I really don't have anything other than the fact that I'm still in Oklahoma. So anyway, next week will be another remote broadcast. The week after, first week in April, I will be back in D.C., and we will be live at Shelley's Back Room. So just one more week of telephonic, symphonic greatness, and then we're back to smoking cigars and drinking Jack and martinis. On behalf of Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, the Honorable Alan Moore, Carl Tuven, Dr. Ralph Winnie, and I think that's it. Who did I miss? The great people of the state of Oklahoma, too. Hey, we'll be back next week on Blog Talk Radio. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob?
Tough place to be.
We'll see you next week. Thanks, people, for joining us. Bye-bye.
So long.